really, he just started experimenting and finding like-minded people around the country who started composting, started growing their own food without chemicals, started looking for natural grocers, started writing letters to the editor in their own newspaper around concerns over chemical agriculture. And that's how the organic movement in this country was born.
Hi there, and welcome back to another episode of Sustaining with Shayna, a show where I will share all the amazing and exciting works of sustainability happening across the eastern foothills of the Appalachian Mountains to the lush farmlands of southeastern Pennsylvania. By celebrating our community, we can help to bridge the gap between local and international sustainability endeavors. Today's guest is Diana Martin. Diana is the Director of Communications and Marketing at the Rodale Institute. Together, we sat down to talk about what the Rodale Institute is and the amazing work that it does and the plethora of research it does in the area of organic farming, regenerative agriculture, and also sustainable agriculture, and the many works it does in the community to bring about organic produce for everyone in the community, including those that are the underserved. So together we talk about so many different varying factors that Rodale addresses. And in fact, we talk so much about Rodale that we actually broke up our discussion across two episodes. So this episode, we talked mostly about just the basics of what Rodale is doing. And then we dabble into a lot more fascinating research that Rodale has been up to lately and has been making a lot of headlines too lately as well. So tune in next week for that episode where we continue just talking about their research, especially regenerative agriculture. Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Sustaining with Shayna. I hope you are all doing well, and I am back from an unexpected month off from the podcast, but have been busy with a lot of work and especially busy creating more content behind the scenes here at Sustaining with Shayna. So, that being said, a lot has happened in the last month, it feels like. The last time I produced an episode was the day before the U.S. General election, especially the presidential election. And there was a lot of uneasiness, definitely, between then and now. And I feel like hopefully now it's a collective sigh of relief in the sense of trying to push environmental policy and legislative work. But we still have more work to do. Just because we will have a new administration in the new year that understands that climate change is an emergency and that we need to take this issue seriously, that doesn't always mean that their head is in the right place all the time. And what I mean by that is even with the new up-and-coming presidential election, we still have elected officials and leaders who will be assuming office that don't necessarily understand the priority in this. And what I mean by that is they still are driving dirty industry and still supporting dirty industry that needs to be phased out sooner than what they're proposing. So that being said, when I recorded this episode and this interview I had with Diana from the Rodale Institute, this was recorded a few days before the election was. So At the beginning of the interview, you'll understand for context as far as us kind of discussing that, and then we kind of bring up some policy measures too, and still there was uncertainty from the both of us as far as how that would play out. But hopefully now with the results that we have, like I said, with a new administration in the new year, that hopefully we will have a new administration that understands that climate change is a real issue and that we need to take it seriously. And hopefully in the process we'll take regenerative agriculture, which is a big part of our discussion with the Rodale Institute, into a more serious outlook. So that being said, let's get into it and hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Sustaining with Shayna. And I feel like this is a great episode to have. It's a two-part series right after the election, something to seriously distract us from what's going on in the world right now, but also to kind of shift gears as far as the content that I've been covering lately. So both this episode and next episode will be about the Rodale Institute. And to talk more about that, Diana, please introduce yourself and what the Rodale Institute is.
Hi, Shayna. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm Diana Martin. I'm the Director of Communications and Marketing at Rodale Institute. And we're a nonprofit organization that's headquartered in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. And our mission is to heal people and the planet with regenerative organic agriculture. So what that means day to day is we do a lot of research on regenerative and organic farming. We do a lot of farmer training, working with farmers who want to implement those practices. And then we do a lot of consumer education. So talking with everyday people about how the decisions of, you know, what they put on their plate every day and what they buy at the grocery store actually impacts their family and the world around them.
Yeah, I feel like that's a perfect way to explain of why it's important to have healthy food and to have highly nutritious food. And in addition to kind of what you introduced with Rodale, what are some things, or how did Rodale get started, or what is Rodale known for? Because I feel like a lot of times when I talk to people here in Berks County in Pennsylvania, that they don't even know that Rodale exists kind of in our own backyard. So, I mean, how did Rodale really get its start as well?
So the Rodale Institute, we've been around for 70 years. And we were started by a man named J.I. Rodale. And he actually wasn't a farmer. He grew up in New York City. He started a successful electrical manufacturing company with his brother. And they had an opportunity to expand their business and move it out of New York and into Pennsylvania. And he moved into the Lehigh Valley. And even though he had this electrical manufacturing company, that wasn't really his passion. His passion was always health. And he came from a family that wasn't healthy. His father had died really young. He had a lot of health struggles as a child. And he was really passionate about how he could grow healthy food for his family. So when he moved out to Pennsylvania, he moved onto a farm and wanted to start growing food, called up Penn State to kind of, you know, figure out how he could do this. And they start talking about all these chemical inputs he could use on the farm. This was in the 1930s, 1940s, where we were coming out of World War II and we were really starting to use chemicals in agriculture for the first time. And, you know, it was called the Green Revolution. We were taking ammunition that actually that we were using in the war and spreading them on farm fields for an increase in yields. And you know, I think J.I. Riddell, since he was sort of an outsider to farming, and he really was going into farming because of his interest in health, that new mentality around agriculture just didn't make sense to him. You know, his question was, how can I take these toxic chemicals and turn them into healthy food for my family? That just doesn't really make sense. So that actually is where the Riddell Institute was born, around this question of what are the long-term implications going to be of chemicals in our food system? And really at the time, he wanted to pay other universities to study this question. And they basically turned him down and said, this is the future of farming. We don't want to take your money. And then he decided that he would really pursue this as his life's passion and his life's work. So J.I. Riddell, he started experimenting on his own farm, which is over in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. And we actually still own that farm. It's a little bit smaller than where our farm where we're headquartered today. And he started writing about his work. He started a publishing company, and some of the titles were magazines like Prevention, which is still on shelves today. He started Organic Gardening magazine. And really, he just started experimenting and finding like-minded people around the country who started composting, started growing their own food without chemicals, started looking for natural grocers, started writing letters to the editor in their own newspaper around concerns over chemical agriculture. And that's how the organic movement in this country was born. Ultimately, J.I. Riddell started this movement, inspired people to start growing without chemicals again. And ultimately that led us to creating the National Organic Program and that, green USDA certified organic seal that you see in grocery stores today. So that's a little bit about our history and, you know, our role in starting and building the organic movement. And today we're really one of the only places in the world that does independent research comparing organic and conventional agriculture. So today we're really well known for our world-class research trials that are very unique and some of the only of their kind anywhere in the world. We're also known for farmers that, you know, we test these methods and we help them be successful with organic. So we find the best ways that they can grow and fight pests and disease and weeds and all the really, the real issues that farmers face. We take that risk on, we do that experimenting, and then we line them up for success so that they can transition to organic. And, you know, people might know us today at the forefront of some of our other initiatives, such as the regenerative organic certification that we recently launched.
Yeah, so Riddell has been very busy in the last 70 years with a lot of things. And personally, I feel like when I've heard of Riddell, a lot of it is signaled around the fact that Riddell being dubbed the founders in the organic farming movement. And would you say that's nationally or internationally?
We work nationally and globally. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, agriculture has a long history over the last 10,000 years, but I think our really claim to fame is helping farmers return to farming with nature, which is something we did a long time before industrial and chemical agriculture. And, you know, we've really championed that in North America, but our work is global, and this movement is global, and farmers are thinking about soil health now really in every continent and every country around the world.
Yeah, and I think the work you do is so important. And taking a step back here a second, because I feel some of the listeners might know that there's the whole aspect of organic produce, and they go to the grocery store, the farmer's market, and where to buy it. But Can you explain what organic farming is? Because I think some people still, even today, might not understand what organic farming is, in the sense of, I think we don't understand the basics of it.
That's a great question. Even a lot of people who buy organic still have questions about what organic means. So when you go to your farmer's market or grocery store and you see that green USDA certified organic label, what that label means is that product was grown without any GMOs, without any synthetic inputs such as herbicides, pesticides, even synthetic fertilizers, which are, you know, they're derived from petroleum and fossil fuels. So, and animal products in organic can't use antibiotics or growth hormones, and the animals have to be raised outdoors on pasture. So there's sort of this long list of rules that farmers have to follow to be organic. And there is a 3-year transition period. So it takes 3 years from the last time you use any prohibited input before you can become certified organic. And a lot of people do ask us, is organic just a marketing term? How do I know if it's real? And the really great thing about the organic label is it's really well vetted. So those organic farmers every year have to have an inspection where a third party person comes to their farm, make sure that they're doing everything they say that they're doing. They have to go through certification. They have to file annual paperwork and fees. And it's completely elective. So the farmers who choose to be organic, they're signing up and saying, yes, I want to follow all of these rules on my farm and have this label that I can communicate to consumers more transparency about how our product is grown.
Yeah, and I think, at least from what I see, is that having the label is helpful as far as transparency goes. But I also know that a lot of times, and this is why it's important to buy fresh and buy local too, is you might have some farmers that can't afford to pay the certification and to get their farms officially certified organic, but they also, a lot of them also follow those policies too. So it's an interesting process, because I think a lot of, at least farms here locally in Berks County, and, or I should say even southeastern Pennsylvania, that some farmers might not be able to afford that certification yet, or for whatever reason. So it's interesting how the certification helps, but then also I think it's important for a consumer to know what goes into organic farming, so then they can ask when they go to purchase that produce. So yeah,
definitely. And I would say Pennsylvania is a leader in the organic movement. I think that's another thing that a lot of people who live here don't necessarily know. So organic was a $55 billion industry in the United States last year. There's about 17,000 certified organic farms all around the country. And Pennsylvania is actually number 3 in the country for organic sales. So California has everyone beat. They always have that number 1 spot. You know, it's such a big state. They have so many farms. They can grow year round and are just a powerhouse in agriculture. But Pennsylvania has actually gone back and forth between that number 2 and number 3 spot. And we do have a lot of organic farmers here in Pennsylvania. So we're a huge leader in this industry.
Just out of curiosity, what is currently the second state with most organic farming? And does that second spot change, or is it pretty consistent with Pennsylvania?
Right now, the number 2 spot is going to Washington State. And one of the reasons is they sell high value organic crops. They sell, if you buy an organic apple, there's a good, and it's produced in the US, there's 99% chance it's coming from Washington. And or produce is really the gateway to organic. So right now we're seeing about 5% of what Americans eat is organic. but it's much higher in produce. We're looking at up to 16% of the produce that Americans eat today is now organic.
That's an interesting statistic. So in general of organic food, it's 5%, but produce specifically is 16%.
And it makes a lot of sense if you think about it. I consider organic produce the sort of the gateway to organic. The number one reason people buy organic is for their health and the health of their family. So a lot of times that equates to buying organic produce. The other thing that's really interesting to me in thinking about the organic consumer is that the number one consumer are millennial families. So millennials are really driving the organic movement. And what we find is actually the demand is outpacing the supply. So I think that that's a really encouraging statistic for everyone listening. Mm-hmm. You're voting with your dollars and it's making a difference. And so many consumers are saying they want to buy organic, that's really what's getting farmers to transition. And the farmland is actually what's lagging behind. So right now, only about 1% of farmland in the U.S. is certified organic, but that's growing and it's really because of consumer demand.
Wow. That's interesting to see how much the change has been happening. And I think, at least from my perspective as a consumer, I think a lot of the places that we buy our produce from, so a lot of those big box corporations, as far as like supermarket chains, are starting to really cover more organic options. One of those I can think of right away is Aldi's, and how Aldi's reaches a different demographic than Whole Foods does. And we always knew that Whole Foods covers pretty much all organic at this point. But it's interesting to see how these different companies that serve different levels of the market as far as what consumers can buy have really been shifting in the direction of organic in general.
Yeah, actually, two of the biggest retailers for organic are Costco and Walmart. I mean, they're obviously huge companies that have a lot of stores, but right now in the U.S., they're the top two retailers for organic food are Walmart and Costco.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think that says a lot about where organic is going and that it's not an elitist movement. It's really something for everyone. And I mean, that's something I feel really strongly about, that good food is a human right. And it shouldn't be something that you have to be in a position of privilege to have access to, or to be affordable or accessible. And I think there's a lot we need to do in that area to make organic the mainstream. Because what we're seeing right now is, you know, we're in the midst of a global health pandemic. People are really worried about their health. And one of the best ways to safeguard your health is through your food and your diet and your nutrition and boosting your immunity. So that's one of the reasons actually organic sales were skyrocketed this spring after the coronavirus pandemic started. We actually saw a 30% increase in organic produce sales just over last year at the same time, as people really, you know, people in our country, unfortunately, just can't afford to get sick. So a lot of people are trying to take those preventative measures. And I think that's where we need to really work as a country to make this food accessible to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it's kind of, there's also a combination of things where I feel like you have consumers that really benefit from it and understand it. And then I still hear consumers out there saying, well, organic food is overpriced. And I mean, is it really better than non-organic food? And having personally changed my diet and started to shift to entirely non-GMO or organic and locally sourced, I've noticed a difference in the sense of how I feel after I've eaten a lot of organic food compared to non-organic. And I really believe that there is an actual difference with it for sure.
Yeah, I think with organic, we try to get people to understand that organic is the real cost of food. That mm-hmm. with a lot of this, you know, conventional, chemical, and processed foods, you're not seeing the full cost of that item at the grocery store checkout. You know, we're subsidizing a lot of that food through farm subsidies. So you're paying for it in your tax dollars. We're paying for that food, that cheap processed chemical food, in our health and our national healthcare costs. You know, we're actually paying the least amount for food as a country since the 1960s and the most for healthcare. Hmm. So we're externalizing some of these costs, and we're definitely paying the cost of that cheap conventional food in the environment. We're degrading our soil. We're, you know, poisoning our air, our water, these resources that are meant to last for future generations. And, you know, also that are affecting our health and that we're paying for in other ways. For example, you know, as a taxpayer, you're paying to dredge the Mississippi River every year because of all the soil erosion coming off of farms in the Midwest. So I think that's one thing. It's a very real question for a lot of families. You're at a grocery store, you're on a limited food budget, you might be pushing a cart with, you know, your toddler, and you're trying to make quick food decisions that make sense for your family. And, you know, I'd like to really see us shift some of our personal mentality. And maybe, for example, maybe you can eat less meat, better meat is one thing that I encourage people. Maybe don't eat meat with every meal or every day of the week, but then look for organic, grass-fed, pasture-raised when you can. But I think a lot of these changes also have to come from a systemic and policy level when it comes to food and farming. But ultimately, to your question, what are the differences? There are a lot of benefits to eating organic. You know, one of them is to your own personal health. We know that organic food has less pesticide residues. There's emerging research that organic food is more nutrient dense, especially when it comes to things like phytonutrients, you know, antioxidants. So those are all things that can boost your health and immunity. And also, I'd like for more people to start considering the health of the farm workers that grow and prepare that food and get it to your table. I think the pandemic, you know, there's definitely some silver linings with coronavirus, and I try to look for them because I'm an optimistic person. And I think one of the silver linings is it really made people appreciate all the essential workers that made their lives possible and allowed, you know, vulnerable people to stay home. I think people started thinking about the people in your grocery stores who are checking you out and the people picking up your trash every day. And I think more people started thinking about when they went to these grocery stores and the shelves were cleared out, where is this food coming from and who is producing it? And I think that raised our level of consciousness around farmers and farm workers. And, you know, our farm workers are disproportionately being harmed by the chemicals and conventional agriculture, to the point that cancers in the farming community are so prevalent. Hodgkin's lymphoma is known as the farmer's cancer. Mm. So I think when we think about, you know, why should I pay more for organic? I think about your health, think about the health of people and safety of the people producing their food and their children who are often in close proximity to those fields. And then of course, I think a lot of people have a better idea of the environmental impacts that, but we can talk more about that because maybe people don't have, that's still something that they're learning about. That, you know, right now, the reality is our soils are alive. It's not just dirt. And the UN says we have about 60 years of farmable topsoil remaining if we keep farming with these industrial chemical practices. There's actually more living things in a teaspoon of healthy soil than there are people on the planet. There's bacteria and fungi. There's this whole microbiome in the soil. And when we do destructive farming practices, like excessive tillage, like spraying herbicides and fungicides, the problem is we're not just killing weeds and we're not just killing pests. We're actually killing all of that life in the soil that is there to support the plant and really is there to keep the whole system in balance. When we kill that life in the soil, we release a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. Instead of using our carbon as our soils as a carbon sink, they can start to mitigate and reverse climate change. When we kill that life in the soil, we see lots of soil erosion and washing away of our topsoils. And ultimately that leads to chemicals ending up in our waterways, in our air, and really it ends up to what we're seeing today, which agriculture is contributing about 25% of our global greenhouse gas emissions. So we know that, you know, right now farming is a little bit of an environmental villain, but there's so much hope and promise that if we did it the right way, it actually could start healing our planet and be a solution to a lot of these problems.
Yeah. And as you were talking about that, the whole entire time I was thinking of, and I had to look up the name as you were talking about it, but I was thinking about Norman Bullock and how that was what in the 70s, he received the Nobel Peace Prize for the fact that I think he was genetically modifying wheat in Mexico. So it could, or was it rice? It was one of the two to help people who were impoverished around the world to have access to food. But it was interesting. I watched a PBS documentary that was done a couple months ago about this and how the fact that when he kept crossbreeding and kept modifying the plant itself, of how much the nutrients were being sucked out of the plant and how, or the plant itself was not nutrient rich, but then how the soil itself was losing its nutrients. And it was interesting because the productivity was the biggest factor of why there was a push to do this. So even though the original, you would probably say more organic based species that was at the beginning of all of this, yeah, you didn't get the same level of yield, but if the original plant was more nutrient rich. And it was fascinating to see how much pesticides or synthetic nutrients that had to be put into the soil just so the crop would be successful. And it's fascinating to watch that, how do we have this in between producing enough yield, but then also not doing it in a way that takes out nutrients in the soil. And it's fascinating to see where the organic farming movement argument is in a sense like that.
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head that really the only thing we've asked farmers to do over the last several decades, really almost 100 years at this point, is to produce the cheapest food possible. So farmers, the only thing they're really measured on is yields. They sell a commodity. They sell, you know, they'd get a price for how many bushels of corn or soybeans they produce. And, you know, the only thing that they've been trying to do is get that higher. How can we get 200 bushels to the acre, 250 bushels to the acre? The push has been for yields, and it's really kind of been a race to the bottom by just using that metric. It's like, how can we do that as cheaply as possible and make the cheapest food possible? Mm-hmm. We haven't asked farmers to produce the healthiest food possible or even food that tastes good. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting, you know, often in organic, people think about organic as all the things we don't do. We don't use emails, but it's really more about what we are doing. It's really about farming with nature, and it's really about soil health and investing in that soil and thinking about good farming practices. How can we cover crop and have a crop rotation, reduce our tillage, you know, get animals outdoors grazing on pasture, you know, put compost in the soil. Organic is really about feeding the life in the soil. And, you know, I think about that almost like a bank. The soil is kind of like a bank. If all you do is every year monocrop corn or soybeans, you're taking money out of the bank, and you're never putting anything in. And then it's going to be empty and zero. And in organic, it's, you know, we think about in between those, you know, cash crops, we put money back in the bank, we cover crop, we compost, so that, you know, we're investing in the future. So I think about it as more of organic is really a long-term approach to farming. And I think our chemical conventional agriculture is very short-sighted. And I think it's promised a lot of things it hasn't been able to deliver on. So you mentioned GMOs, the whole promise of GMOs. People ask us all the time, we can't use GMOs in organic. And people ask us, you know, are you anti-science? What's the reason that we can't use GMOs? They're, you know, offer all these great benefits to the planet. And we're definitely not anti-science. I think organic is the future. We are a research institute studying organic. We have tons of science behind what we do. The problem with GMOs is we've just been sold a false bill of goods. We were promised once we use GMOs, we can reduce the amount of chemicals that we use in agriculture. And that's not true. Since we've introduced GMOs, we're using more chemicals in farming than we ever have before. And a lot of it is because GMOs are just a short-sighted solution. Most GMOs that we use, they're genetically modified for one reason, which is to withstand Roundup, which is glyphosate, so that we can douse them with glyphosate and the plant doesn't die and the weeds around it do. But like I said, it's not just the weeds that are dying, it's the whole life in the soil. And those are the practices that are telling us that now that we only have 60 harvests left. So I think that's our big thing with GMOs. It's not that we're anti-science, it's that they're a short-sighted solution that really ends up just getting farmers on a sort of hamster wheel where they rely on inputs. Then they have to buy the GMO seed. Then they have to buy the herbicide that's engineered to work with the GMO seed. And then because they're doing all this bad stuff to their soil, they have to buy all these other expensive inputs to give it enough nitrogen and potassium. And so we want to get farmers off the hamster wheel and actually allow them to thrive, be independent, farm with nature, to be profitable and not just to be stuck in a system that is really decimating our rural communities all around the country.
Absolutely. And as you were saying that, one thing I was thinking of is during the pandemic, I learned, because of the fact that I love to garden and do it barefoot, and realizing on that level too, that there are so many good things in the soil and how all these different microorganisms are in the soil that even just our human touch and interaction with the soil, let alone consuming produce that's grown in that soil, is so beneficial for our health.
We're finding a lot of connections between, you know, I think people are more aware of their gut microbiome and the important role that it plays in their health, that, you know, you have all this bacteria in your body that helps you function better. And we're finding more connections between that, you know, good bacteria and microbiome in our gut and the microbiome in our soil. So if we kill off the microbiome in our soil, and it's that microbiome, it's not in the plants and in the food that we eat, and then it's not in us. So ultimately, you know, we have so many connections to soil. The word human comes from humus, which means soil. So I think we've engineered these like divisions between us and literally the ground that we stand on. And I think we need to go back to understanding that at the end of the day, what we do to the soil is what we do to ourselves. And without healthy soil, we can't have healthy people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like that's a perfect way to segue into talking both about organic farming and earlier you talked about regenerative agriculture. So first, what is regenerative agriculture and how is that different than per se organic farming?
That's a great question. Regenerative is definitely a new buzzword right now in food and farming. And I think, you know, more people are hearing that term. And thanks to some brands who are sort of championing regenerative and doing more consumer-facing initiatives and, you know, through educational efforts. There's actually a great film right now on Netflix called Kiss the Ground that just came out recently, all about regenerative agriculture and its role in fighting climate change. And Rodale Institute is featured in that film, so definitely give that a watch. But yeah, I would say the important things to know about the differences between organic and regenerative is, you know, I mentioned before that organic kind of has this really stringent framework and criteria and certification process and vetting. There's actually a whole, it's a federal program under the USDA. So it's actually illegal to say that your products were grown organically if they don't meet all of that criteria. Hmm. Regenerative doesn't have any strict definition at this point. It's basically just a holistic way about thinking about farming. And it's a lot of people think about regenerative as just good farming practices that build soil health. So things like reducing your tillage and cover cropping and composting. And a lot of people who are excited about regenerative agriculture is because they're interested in its potential to sequester carbon and to start to mitigate and reverse climate change. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in the regenerative movement. And there's also a little bit of greenwashing going on in the regenerative movement. So that's just an important thing to know as a consumer that, you know, someone can say that something is regenerative and still be using GMOs or pesticides. Maybe they're working to limit the amount of chemicals that they're using. And, you know, I personally celebrate any step a farmer takes moving from conventional towards conservation and regenerative practices to towards organic. Maybe they're not at organic yet, but there's a lot somewhere in the journey. And then we also have farmers who are regenerative who are just doing amazing things to heal their land. So that's an emerging movement that is basically saying we don't have to continue to degrade our resources, but we also just can't keep doing what we're doing now. Sustainability isn't good enough. Regenerative is about improving the land and even the communities and health through the way that we farm. And yeah, we actually, for people who are interested in regenerative and do want to make sure that there's some actual criteria behind the use of that term, we recently have worked with some other brands and nonprofits, and we have introduced a new regenerative organic certification. And it actually goes above and beyond the existing USDA organic label. So this is a new add-on label. It meets all the criteria of organic, but has stricter criteria for soil health, for animal welfare, and there's an entire farm worker fairness component, which is something I'm really passionate about that's been left out of the organic movement. So if you buy something that's organic, you know, technically it could be made with child labor in another, you know, foreign country, or you don't really know anything about how the farmers or farm workers were treated. And for us, I think, for the regenerative organic certification, one of the main goals is to consider how every living thing in that system was treated, from soil microbe to plant to animal to person that's part of that system. So when you look for that ROC label, you know that it's benefited every living thing in that process.
Yeah, actually, as you're talking about that, I remember I was at a I think I was at, it was a talk that I went to, and I was at the UN climate talks back in 2017 that I originally saw the regenerative organic certification. So it's not anything that's super new in the sense of that it just came out this year, that it's been a growing process in these last few years for sure.
We've been working on it for years, and we hit some really exciting milestones this year where the first regenerative organic certified products are now officially on the market. So you can actually start buying products that are ROC. Some of the brands that have ROC products are Patagonia, Dr. Bronner's, Nature's Path. There's some really great brands who have been doing it. And the certification is now open to any farm or any company who wants to get certified. So we went through a whole pilot and tested the certification. We've really come pretty far over the last couple of years. And if you're a farmer listening to this and you want to learn more about getting certified, you can do that at regenorganic.org.
Awesome. And so next week, we'll kind of go into more detail about regenerative agriculture, and I could ask some more questions as well as far as the more specifics about it and also how that correlates to the white paper that Rodale recently wrote and released. But I feel like that's a good segue into my next question is, so Rodale as an institute does a lot of research, and this is kind of a two-part question. So what would you say Rodale is most known for when it comes to their research, and also what is Rodale currently working on as far as research goes?
Awesome questions. So our research has three primary focus areas. The first is just developing practical solutions for farmers to deal with pests, disease, and weeds without using chemical inputs. So all of our research is very solutions-based. It's meant to be used by real farmers all over the country, all over the world. So that's one of our focus areas. Another one of our research focus areas is climate change. So how can farmers continue to farm with the extreme weather that they're facing? And how can we help them be more resilient and even start to mitigate and reverse climate change through our work in agriculture? And our third focus area is human health. Our motto for 70 years has been healthy soil equals healthy food equals healthy people. And at the end of the day, that's one of our big concerns, is how can we use food and farming to contribute to human health? And how can we grow more nutrient-dense food that helps solve food insecurity? So those are our big focus areas. We have a number of research trials. If you come to our farm in Kutztown or any of our other satellite sites around the country, we grow all kinds of stuff. At our headquarters, we have grains and vegetables and livestock and orchards and honeybees. It's the coolest part, I think, about working on an experimental farm. We always have tons of different research projects going on. But we have a couple that are pretty famous. One of them is called our farming systems trial. And it's basically a side-by-side comparison. We grow organic grain crops. We grow conventional grain crops in the same fields, same soil type, you know, and we're able then to, we've been doing that trial for 40 years. It's actually the longest running comparison of organic and conventional in North America. So we've been doing that trial since 1981. And in that, we're able to study so many amazing things. We're able to compare. The side-by-side part's really important because we know that it's the same soil types, they're the same crops, it's the same weather, everything is the same. But we're able to study the differences in things like the soil health, how much water they use, how much energy they use, yields, how profitable are they for the farmers. And that research has really, that research has proven that organic can feed the world. What we found was after, you know, a few years of transition, when we were able to rebuild that life in the organic system, in the organic fields, there's no statistical difference between the organic and conventional. And actually, when we have years of inclement weather, like drought or flooding, the organic system can have up to 40% higher yields because it's more resilient because of the soil health and the life in the soil. We've also found that the organic systems use less energy, release fewer carbon emissions, and probably the thing that I'm most excited about, it's more profitable for farmers, up to 3 to 6 times more profitable. And at the end of the day, you know, farming is a business. So that's a really important metric, because if you want more farmers to transition, they have to be able to, you know, make a living and a livelihood and be willing to go through that transition period and learn a lot of new things and, you know, take risks to change their whole farm over to organic. So those are some of our results in that trial. We have a vegetable systems trial where we compare organic versus conventional produce. And we focus a lot on the differences of what we call nutrient density, which is basically the nutrition of the produce. And our most recent long-term trial is called the Watershed Impact Trial. And that is a 40-acre research project we're doing in Chester County in Pennsylvania, in partnership with the Stroud Water Research Center. And in that trial, we're learning all about how we farm ultimately impacts our watersheds and clean water, which impact all, you know, of course, wildlife, but that's also our drinking water. So it again connects back to human health. So those are a couple examples of our research trials, but we are really looking at a number of different things, and I think all of our research is really exciting.
Yeah, and I think the last one you mentioned is really fascinating, because I went through the Penn State Extension's Master Watershed Steward training about 3 years ago, and one of the things we talked about with watershed health is ways in which we're trying to get farmers across Pennsylvania to develop best management practices and how they regulate even on their own property runoff, whether that's just soil erosion or also nutrients, what or pesticides, whatever it may be, and how that affects downstream, or because a lot of times it seems as though there are streams that run through farms, and what impact does that make? And also, fun fact for the listeners, this is always something I love to test people's knowledge about, but our biggest pollutant here in Pennsylvania is actually runoff. And it's interesting to hear what people say, but because we're such a heavily agricultural state, that it only makes sense that runoff is the largest pollutant here. But also one of the things that I've been curious about, and we can go into more detail about this next week as well, but I think a lot of the work that I've been seeing as somebody that doesn't live far from Rodale and that's followed the news, that there's this, I think, isn't it a cooperative research project as well as far as the whole hemp farming? Because can you just like briefly talk about that in the sense of what that means? And we could definitely go into more detail next week, but I think it's also, I guess, good to bring that up as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been doing hemp research for 4 years at this point. And if you're not into farming, the reason hemp is so exciting to everyone right now in agriculture is because it was actually illegal to grow hemp in the United States for 80 years. And that has recently changed in the 2018 Farm Bill, just legalized hemp for American farmers. So that's pretty exciting to everyone. We were able to grow it a little bit earlier than that, because the previous Farm Bill had legalized it for research. So we kind of got a little bit of a jump start on everyone else. So this is our fourth year growing hemp. But Yeah, hemp is pretty exciting. It's actually, you know, it was classified as a Schedule I drug in the United States because it's part of the cannabis family. It looks a lot like marijuana. It smells a lot like marijuana, but it's not marijuana. It's not actually psychoactive. It's not a drug. It's used for things like fiber. Industrial hemp is like a really strong fiber that can be used for ropes and uniforms. We used to use it for ship sails, like all of this kind of stuff. And there's a lot of uses for hemp where people use it for the seed and also the oil. So if you notice that there's sort of a craze these days around CBD, that's coming from hemp. So everyone was pretty excited that it was legalized for farmers to grow in the 2018 Farm Bill. But everyone had a lot of questions because we haven't grown hemp in the United States for 80 years. And Pennsylvania had a huge hemp history. I live in Lancaster County, and the school district next to mine is called Hempfield. That was, you know, this was a really important crop to our state. But a lot's happened in those 80 years. So we actually have spent the last couple of years researching what grows well in the Mid-Atlantic region. There's tons of varieties of hemp that have emerged over the last 80 years. So we're planting those different varieties, seeing what grows well in our region. We are really excited and organic to learn more about hemp's potential to suppress weeds. So one of the cool things about hemp is it can grow really tall, really fast. There's actually varieties of hemp that can grow 15, 20 feet in 4 months. So it just shoots up. It literally grows like a weed. I think that, you know, that's why it's known as weed. Cannabis is known as weed. It grows like a weed. So we're pretty excited in organic. One of our biggest challenges in organic is dealing with weed pressure because we can't spray herbicides. So we're studying to see if farmers put it in their crop rotation, does hemp grow so fast that it shades out all the weeds and kills the weeds, and then even gives a benefit to the next crop that we plant on that field? Because hemp grows so fast and can shade out all the weeds and kill all the weeds, that means they won't drop weed seeds, so that in our next rotation, if we plant soybeans, where we have a higher yield without having to ever use chemicals, just by putting hemp in the rotation. So that's one of the things that we're researching that we're pretty excited about. And the results are looking really good so far. Our first couple years have shown that it is helping suppress weeds, and we are seeing greater yields. And we're also seeing lots of other great benefits from hemp. It's easy to grow without a lot of chemicals. Pollinators love it. And hopefully this is a new market that provides some opportunities for American farmers.
Yeah, it seems as though hemp has being dubbed also as this universal plant or this miracle plant, in the sense that not only could it be used in the ways you described, but it could be used even as a buffer in wetlands because of how the root system is and how it can grow quickly, to how the fiber in the hemp can be used to make concrete. I mean, there was, I think it was the National or the American Hemp Association always has a stand, and a fairly sizable stand, at the Pennsylvania Farm Show every year. And it's always cool to see what they bring with them, showing what's made out of hemp. And it's interesting how, I don't know if it's the current model, but the the BMW i3 series, how that's made almost entirely or a significant portion of that vehicle is actually made with hemp.
I think the paneling in the car is made from hemp. Yeah. It's pretty exciting. And I mean, there are challenges around hemp. But I think one of the things I am excited about is it's really getting a lot of young people interested in farming. There's sort of been this resurgence of all these new beginning farmers that want to get into it just because of hemp, and they're really excited about that crop. But yeah, some of the challenges are we just don't have a lot of infrastructure for hemp yet in our country because of the prohibition for 80 years. There aren't a lot of processing facilities, for example. So the market is lagging a little bit of some of that infrastructure needs. The farmers are excited to grow it. And I think, you know, it's sort of building some of the other elements of the supply chain from to get it to market.
Yeah, I think one of the discussions I had was actually at the farm show with somebody earlier this year that said there is enough land and enough interest in Pennsylvania to grow a significant portion of hemp, but that middle portion of the supply chain is lacking, in the sense that how do you get the hemp that's harvested, and there's sometimes not the right vehicles to be even used to properly harvest the hemp, and then how do you get the hemp between where it's grown to where it can even be processed?
Yeah, there's still a lot of challenges. Our first year growing hemp, we had no idea how to harvest it. We didn't have any of the right equipment. And these are the same challenges all the farmers are having. And that's why it's great for institutions like us to kind of do research so that when farmers go to do it, we solve some of these challenges. But our first year, we had to use like an old-fashioned sickle to actually harvest it because it's so tough. You can't just run it through a normal, you know, combine or something. So yeah, there's definitely some challenges around hemp, and some of it is just still the legal requirements. Hemp can only have a 0.03% THC content. And if you go over that THC content, let's say you plant some seeds and in your soil or climate, it bumps up a little bit higher. You end up with a 0.05% THC content. And you can compare that to like some strains of marijuana could be a 20% THC content. But if you go over that 0.03 THC content, you have to destroy your whole crop. So there's definitely still some challenges around the regulations around hemp. And, a lot of things are moving in a positive direction. I just saw recently that they're allowing banks to do more financing around hemp. There were a lot of restrictions for financial institutions around cannabis. So they're easing up around some of that around hemp, which is pretty exciting. And there are, you know, brands that are trying to bring their hemp manufacturing home to America. One brand is Patagonia. I see you have your Patagonia sweatshirt on. They use a lot of hemp in some of their lines, like their workwear line. And they're working right now to move their hemp production back to the U.S. It looks like they're looking at growing it in Colorado. So I think, you know, if we can get more companies to support American farmers growing hemp, I think ultimately that will be helpful for farmers.
And I can't imagine all the benefits to the economy that can play into. And hearing you say that excites me so much, because these are factors of where I see facets of the Green New Deal coming into reality and fruition, that it's this whole new sector of the agricultural industry and what that can mean on so many different levels, whether it's for the environment or for the farming industry itself, to in general the U.S. economy as well.
Farming connects to everything. I think that's why one of the reasons that makes me so excited about farming and thinking about it as, you know, the potential it has to really create solutions to some of our most challenging issues, because farming is more than just what you eat. It is connected to your health, the environment, the economy. It's a global system that if we did it the right way, this is kind of the promise of regenerative organic agriculture. If we farmed the way that we know is possible, we could heal people and the planet.
I feel like that's a great way to segue into My last question, and then I have a couple more like personal questions for you afterwards. So my last question right now is for the listeners, especially who are local and may have never heard of Rodale, which I feel like there's a lot of them out there. What is something you would like them to know about Rodale?
There are ways for you to get involved. I would say our farm, our headquarters that are in Kutztown, Pennsylvania, they're open to the public. We actually have a little store and visitor center. You can come out and visit us. We have a free walking tour of the farm. It's an audio tour. So you can come out with your family on a Saturday, you know, stop by our visitor center, bring a picnic lunch, walk the farm, tour it. You can see, you know, some of our animals. You know, the farming season is just winding down. So if you want to stay in the loop with us, jump on our website, rodaleinstitute.org. You can sign up for our email list or follow us on social media, because come spring, we're hopeful with, we'll see with the direction with COVID next year, but we do lots of events and workshops, everything from film screenings at the farm to yoga at the farm, cooking demonstrations, apple picking. You can come out and do workshops on organic gardening or beekeeping. And so I encourage you to come visit us, get involved in maybe an event or workshop. We even have our own organic produce CSA. We sell our own organic pork. So if you're looking to get more of these foods in your diet, there's ways that we could partner together there. And you know, ultimately, I would say if you're local, you could also volunteer. But yeah, I think we need support and we need partners to really make this happen. We're focusing a huge amount of our time right now on working one-on-one with farmers who want to transition to organic. We have more than 100 farms we're working directly with, like sitting with the farmers at their kitchen tables and helping them transition acres to organic. And if that's something that you're passionate about, we would invite your support. We can use donations for that work and would encourage you to visit rodaleinstitute.org/donate and consider, you know, giving $5 a month or $10 a month to support these farmers who, the only way we're still going to have family farms in Pennsylvania is by helping those farmers be profitable and invest in their soil health and by helping them transition away from conventional agriculture. So if that's something you feel passionate about, we could use your support.
Perfect. Yeah, I feel like that's a good way to sum it all up. Because Rodale is not just a research institution. And I think I first learned about Rodale when the Mid-Atlantic Renewable Energy Association used to have their festivals every September out in Kempton, Pennsylvania. And that was the first time discovering who Rodale is. And over time, it's been fascinating to watch and see the work that Rodale has done. And there's so many different benefits. So it's not just research, but it's really tangible services that Rodale services the community. Because one of the other things that I don't think you mentioned was Rodale goes to different farmers markets around the region. And also, don't you have a program that help service low-income people as well? And you have a program with, I think it's St. Luke's Health Network in the Lehigh Valley, and how you grow produce on one of the sites that's even used in the kitchen at one of the hospitals. So yeah.
We have so many awesome things going on. Everyone needs to sign up for our email list, because we'll need, you know, a couple more hours to talk about all of them. But we do have a farm at St. Luke's Hospital at their Anderson campus, which is in Easton, Pennsylvania. And we're farming there on 11 acres. We're growing organic produce that is served throughout the entire hospital network that
ends up in cafeterias and patient menus, and that's been really exciting because it didn't make sense to us. Why are hospitals known for terrible food when these are our most vulnerable people who need the healthiest, most nutrient-dense food? So that's been a really cool project. And yeah, we do have our farm share has a little bit of a special model that really focuses on getting that produce to low-income families who live in food deserts and rely on SNAP dollars. So if you know a family who is using federal food assistance dollars, often known as SNAP benefits, and they're in the Lehigh Valley area, definitely connect them with us as we go into our next CSA, our farming season in the spring, because we really want to make sure the goal of that program is to make organic produce affordable and accessible to especially low-income families.
Absolutely. So with that being said, let's leave it at that for this week, and we can talk more in detail about a lot of this great stuff next week as well. So in the meantime, as a nice way to do a send-off, I have a couple questions for you. So in your mind, what would you say sustainability is?
I like to use the word regenerative. I feel like, to me, the new sustainability is regenerative, that we can't continue to degrade our resources, but it's not good enough to just do no harm. I think that's what a lot of people equate with sustainability: do the least amount of harm possible. And I'm at the point where I'm motivated by regenerative, where we can actually do things to improve the world around us and make it better instead of just doing the least amount of harm.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to sum it up, because I think we can't just look at the here and now, but we have to look at the future and how we plan for that. So if you were to sum
that might have been a cop out, but
yeah. So if you were to sum that up into one word, what would you have it as?
Healing.
Yeah, I think that's a great word to use. And it's been interesting to hear the different responses from guests over these last few episodes. I've heard sustain as one, to green, to healing. So it's interesting to see how everybody approaches sustainability in a different way. And so my last question is, if you could do anything when it comes to sustainability, if you were to wake up tomorrow and you could have a dream job related to sustainability, what would it be and why?
I think I'm lucky. I feel like I have a dream job and, you know, working at Rodale Institute to work at a beautiful farm that aligns with my values. I would say if I could wave a magic wand, I would love to see, you know, I work at a nonprofit, and there's so many of us in the nonprofit space that are so passionate about these issues. And the reality is we can't do it without the corporations getting on board, and we can't do it without the for-profit businesses and companies changing their supply chains and becoming more regenerative and more organic and supporting these farmers and these practices. So I think that's my hope for the future, that it's not just us, you know, nonprofit folks who are really passionate, but there need to be a lot more people in the business world who think about people, planet, profit, if we ultimately want to transform the way food is produced around the world and have a true impact.
Yeah, I feel like that's a perfect way to sum it up, because we need everybody involved in the process to make these efforts possible. That's a great way to pause the conversation for now and pick back up next week. So thanks so much, Diana, for this first part of our conversation. And I'm so glad we decided to do this as a two-part series, just because there's so much information about Rodale and the amazing work that's being done there that I just think one episode did not do it any justice.
Well, I'm really looking forward to talking more. And yeah, if people have questions they want us to cover on the next episode, definitely share them, and we're excited to dive a little deeper.
Absolutely. Well, for now, thank you, Diana. And everybody tune back in next week as we talk more about Rodale's research, especially the white paper that was recently released.
That sounds great. Yeah, we'll nerd out a little bit more about the science behind regenerative organic agriculture and the climate crisis next week. So tune in Perfect. For that topic.
Yeah, I'm excited. Thanks for listening to another episode of Sustaining with Shayna. You can now listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor.fm, and many other platforms. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and, of course, leave a review or comment. To follow us on Facebook or Instagram, go to sustainingwithshayna.com. Also, what you read and listen to here on the platform was carefully created and curated content made just for you, the listeners. Any generous donations can help to keep me supplying you with great content. Just go to Sustaining with Shayna's website. Click on the donate page to donate. Glad you're here. Thanks a million for listening.